This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there and welcome to Between the Lines, on air, online or via your ABC Listen app. This is Tom Switzer and it's always great to have your company. Now later on in the show, a new biography of Neville Bonner pays tribute to our first Indigenous Member of Parliament.
Whilst we, the Aboriginal people, the first Australians, make up 2% of the Australian population, there is not an Aboriginal voice in the Federal Parliament. Rightly or wrongly, I feel that there'll never be another one in my lifetime.
That's Neville Bonner. Stay with us as author Sean Jacobs describes the events that took place 50 years ago. But first, how is the reclusive nation of North Korea handling the COVID pandemic? Well, there's very little information that escapes North Korea, so it's often difficult to know what's really going on inside the Hermit Kingdom. And that's especially been the case during the COVID pandemic, with the country closing its borders completely. Last week, though, a midnight parade in Pyongyang marked the 73rd anniversary of North Korea's founding. The 37-year-old dictator, Kim Jong-un, he appeared, well, looking remarkably slimmer than just a few months ago. So does the North Korean leader's slimmer waistline represent a sign that perhaps Kim is healthier? If so, does that just improve his position at home? Or does a sudden weight loss reflect a health condition? If so, is the jockeying for his succession happening? Jean Lee is a senior fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington and a former Pyongyang bureau chief for the Associated Press. Jean, welcome to ABC's RN.
It's great to join you.
Now, Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, and grandfather, Kim Il-sung, they both died of heart attacks. So what's the significance of Kim's significant weight loss?
Actually, North Koreans consider being plump a sign of prosperity and success. So this is, you know, of course, only the elites can afford to eat well in North Korea. But in Kim Jong-un's case, his weight has crept up over the years. I've seen him over the past 10 years. At first, it was a little bit of baby fat, but it became a lot more than that. Clearly, somebody has said, you need to address this.
Okay, well, let's change the subject and talk about COVID. Now, North Korea claims it's had no cases of COVID in the entire country, which is extraordinary. How's the regime handled the COVID crisis since early 2020, Jean?
It is hard to believe that they've had no COVID. I mean, this is a country that has a long border with China, but they sealed the borders in late January 2020, so really quickly, because they know that they just don't have the infrastructure to handle a pandemic. And so when you spend time in North Korean hospitals, you know that they don't have heat. You know they don't have running water. They don't have medicine. And so all the posters on the walls are about preventative care. So this was the most extreme form of preventative care. And, you know, I was just looking at the WHO website today. It's kind of amazing. You scroll all the way to the bottom of the worldwide tally, and you've got some Pacific nations, some island nations, and then North Korea with zero confirmed cases. It boggles the mind. But I suppose it's technically possible that if you haven't tested that many people and you tested it long after the early months of the outbreak, that we're just missing the outbreak itself.
Well, you mentioned that the regime sealed the border tightly. So that means they've cut off nearly all trade with its largest trade partner, China. So they're impeding the flow of people and goods across the border. Now, at the same time, surely their infertile lands presumably makes a bad situation worse, right?
That's a really good point. And your country has pretty strict rules, right? For people going in and out of the country. But it's more than just people that they've shut out. It's everything that you need for an economy to flourish, for people to flourish. So medicine's not coming, like you said. This is a country that was just shafted when it comes to their environment. And they need everything that you need for farming so that they can grow crops. And so none of that has been coming in since January 2020. So we're seeing a little bit of trade from China. But also, they can't export goods, so they're not making money from exports. I mean, it's always difficult in North Korea, even in the best of times. I can't even imagine what it's like right now with nothing going in and out of the country.
And we should stress that North Korea is dealing with not just the pandemic, but also flooding the US-led sanctions. So what's the significance of Kim calling the food situation in North Korea tense?
Well, I think the acknowledgement on the part of Kim Jong-un is important. It suggests that he recognizes that there's just no way to gloss over the hardships that the North Korean people are going through right now. And I do hope that it sets the stage for North Korea to begin accepting humanitarian aid, which a huge portion of the population relies on. So I'd say that any admission on Kim's part is very welcome. I think he does want to show some vulnerability. He wants to show he's human, and that helps us see him as more of a person than a caricature. But I think we have to be mindful that Kim Jong-un puts a spin on everything, including the food shortage. And he's been blaming outside forces, the climate, the United States, and the pandemic. And then he wants to paint himself as a picture of the savior of his people. But I would say that in reality, it's his decisions that are putting his people in harm's way. He's prioritizing the production of banned nuclear weapons that draw these sanctions. He's prioritizing the construction of amusement parks. They may keep the elite happy, but that means the countryside remains completely underdeveloped and very vulnerable to this annual flooding. So there is some propaganda in that messaging. There is some spin in his messaging.
My guest is Jean Lee from the Wilson Center in Washington. Now, in 2011, Jean became the first American reporter granted extensive access on the ground in North Korea. And in 2012, she opened the Associated Press Pyongyang Bureau. It's the only U.S. bureau based in the North Korean capital. Now, Jean, we've been talking about COVID and the food situation in North Korea. At the same time, the regime is doubling down on its culture war, warning citizens to stay away from all things South Korean, including its fashion, music, even slang. What's going on here?
It's so fascinating. While I was there, people would want to show off how much they had been learning from South Korean dramas. And so what that tells us is that there were a number of elites who were getting out of the country, who were working and living in Beijing, elsewhere, watching South Korean dramas and taking those newfound tastes back to North Korea. And I think Kim Jong-un is trying to crack down on access to that because he can't give it to them. He can't give them all those creature comforts that they now desire. And it's interesting because they've gone back and forth. There was a period in 2018 when we had this brief period of diplomacy between South Korea and North Korea, and of course, North Korea and the United States. We had South Korean pop stars perform in Pyongyang, and that may have been a brief period where he was telling his people, it's okay. But now that they're at a different political stance, he's trying to crack down again and trying to bring them back to what's North Korean.
So when he came to power in 2011, Gene, he initially favoured a more liberal approach and, as you say, mentioned the Western music and the South Korean music. But your point is that the rising knowledge about the outside world and about probably how much worse things are in North Korea, that could erode his regime's legitimacy.
I think it's a very difficult issue that he's been grappling with. Kim Jong-un knows that he needs to open up, that he needs to bring in information from the outside world if the economy wants to develop, if they want to be more sophisticated. But he also threatens to expose them to what the world is like and what they can't have inside North Korea. And that could result in people questioning things, could result in a loss of control. And I think what we're seeing is Kim Jong-un, the regime, trying to wrest back that control over the people who've gotten a little bit too lax and a little bit too comfortable with outside influence. So absolutely, it's a hard question. He wanted to open up to a certain degree, wants his people to be more sophisticated, but he doesn't want to lose control.
Now, finally, this week, North Korea fired a new long-range cruise missile capable of hitting much of Japan. It's reportedly resumed plutonium production for its nuclear arsenal. Now, given these ominous messages, Gene, is there any scope for the Biden administration to engage with Pyongyang, just as the Trump administration tried to do?
They absolutely have to try to do what they can to curb North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And I say this because my family is in South Korea. I certainly don't want the Korean people, North or South, to be living under the specter of this growing threat. And it's not just the Koreans. The region and the world are under threat if North Korea continues on this path. I do think that Kim Jong-un does want to eventually get to the negotiating table, but he wants to get there in a stronger position. He perhaps realized that what he had wasn't enough when he sat down with President Trump. He left those talks in Hanoi in 2019 empty-handed. And so he's been using the time since then to make that program stronger, to build up his arsenal so that North Korea is more of a threat and he has more to negotiate with. And so, you know, I think that people think North Korea's been quiet, but I'm always saying, you know, they're still building nuclear weapons. They're still expanding their capability, maybe quietly, but we should always be wary of what they're doing while we're not watching. You know, Kim Jong-un is playing a long game. His strategy is to focus on nuclear weapons and all the glory and the windfalls he thinks it'll bring him. So these tests that North Korea has carried out, it just raises that sense of urgency. That's precisely why they tested them. They served as a reminder that while you've been preoccupied with other issues, Afghanistan, with pandemic, we've still been building our nuclear weapons.
Okay, but what about Trump's diplomatic gestures in 2018, 2019? We all remember those famous summits in Singapore and then Vietnam. Have they had any material effect on how we see North Korea and how North Korea sees the world? Gene?
You know, I do have to give President Trump some credit for this bold move of drawing Kim Jong-un out of isolation. He provided this opportunity for Kim Jong-un to step out, and that helped us see him as more of a person than a caricature. I mean, I've seen him in real time myself because I've spent a lot of time around him, but the rest of the world hadn't seen him in real time. And I can't emphasize how unusual that was. And I still remember being able to see him live on TV and realize that he's a real person, I think, had a huge impact in starting to see the North Koreans as not just this fictional place, but a real country. That said, having a summit with Kim Jong-un gave him a certain amount of legitimacy that I think was very dangerous, in the sense that it meant that he could tell his people, look, I am so important that the President of the United States sat down with me. And that just gave him so much more legitimacy to carry out policies that arguably have been terrible for his people. So I think there are two sides to it. There's the good and the bad, and I try to recognize both. But my hope is that we can build on the diplomacy successes that were made in 2018. We're not there at this point, but hopefully at some point we can draw them back out. He's done it before, and hopefully we can get him back out again.
The long game continues. Gene, thanks so much for being on ABC Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.
Gene Lee is with the Wilson Center in Washington and a former Pyongyang bureau chief for the Associated Press. She also hosts a podcast on BBC World Service.
This is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
I saw my responsibilities as a parliamentarian was my almost all-consuming, burning desire to help my own people, the Aboriginal community, to become respected, responsible citizens within the broader Australian community. I was treated totally as an equal on my feet, but I think there was a feeling that I was a lesser person. I was a member of the party, fiercely, proudly a member of the party, but I was not blindly a member of the party. Whilst we, the Aboriginal people, the first Australians, make up 2% of the Australian population, there is not an Aboriginal voice in the federal parliament. Rightly or wrongly, I feel that there'll never be another one in my lifetime. I am Neville Bonner, proudly an Aborigine and proudly a member of this Australian community. I am a token for no person.
It's Neville Bonner there, our nation's first Aboriginal parliamentarian, a Liberal senator from 1971 to 1983. Sean Jacobs, a Papua New Guinean-born writer, is author of a new biography on Neville Bonner, and it's published by Connor Court. G'day, Sean.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Now, it's been 50 years since Neville Bonner came to Canberra. Take us back to 1971.
Sure, Tom. So this, of course, was 4 years since the landmark 1967 referendum. Understandably, there's a bit of an atmosphere of activism that existed at the time, you know, especially around Indigenous affairs. And Bonner, however, I think had enjoyed his time on the other end of the spectrum when it came to activism. He was head of the Brisbane-based One People of Australia League, which was very much a non-radical organisation that was focused on integration and assimilation for Indigenous Australians. He'd formally joined the Liberal Party in the late 60s, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But he was definitely a blue-collar man. He'd spent two decades on Palm Island, and up until around the late 1960s, he was a bridge carpenter, and he famously said that he'd worked every job known to man. So he followed an interesting route to Parliament, Tom, in 1971, as you mentioned, 50 years ago.
Yes, and he was born in 1922 under a tree.
That's right. You know, his mother, Julia, gave birth to him in extremely difficult conditions. He was born, as you know, under a tree on Eucaraba Island, which is in northern New South Wales, just right on the mouth of the Tweed River. So although he did move to Lismore at a young age, he'd say that the fact that he survived was a miracle, given what was going on in those days. And looking back, there was just a slightly amusing instance, again, with the distance of time that emerged from his birth in later years. Bonner actually spent the majority of his life, at least until 1970, thinking he was actually born in 1917. He only discovered this actually after filling out his Senate paperwork and having to go back to Lismore in 1970 for his birth records. So it was kind of the problem that you want to have having a few years back, but it was just a lighter look back.
He lost his mother at an early age, and he never met his English dad.
Probably around 1933, Bonner's mother, Julia, passed away. So he was cared for by his grandmother, Ida, and he said that everything that he achieved or was likely to achieve in life was down to his granny. I think above all, he probably learned his eloquence from her. You know, whenever you hear Bonner speak, you know, as we did at the top of the show, you hear he's incredibly well enunciated. And I think that's due to his grandmother in those formative years in the 30s, and despite, of course, only doing a year of formal schooling as well.
Now, in this era, of course, racism was more evident than it is today. Tell us about his experience with racism.
Yes, that's right, Tom. So he experienced racism from a very early age. Likely the most heartbreaking is an instance I describe at the start of the book. An opportunity had emerged for Bonner and his brother Henry to attend South Lismore School, and his mother Julia didn't have any money at all for school uniforms, so she ended up fashioning them out of basically inside-out calico sacks. But so they rocked up to the school, and about an hour after they'd arrived, at about 9:30 in the morning, the school had cleared out. So word had gone viral, at least by 1930s standards, that two black boys were in the school and parents had come to spirit their children away. And of course, this wasn't the only instance of genuine racism he endured over his life, you know, as he moved throughout northern New South Wales and central Queensland, but a tough start.
Now, take us back again to 1971. He fills a Senate vacancy. Now, before that, he'd been a campaigner for Christian and anti-communist causes. Tell us more, because he was a Catholic, right?
That's right, Tom. So he was head of the One People of Australia League, or OPAL as it was called. And as you know, this was an anti-communist organisation, but very much focused on integration and assimilation. And I think really arming Indigenous Australians with the right kind of safety net, but building skills to work, live and cope in a modern Australia. So it was a very natural home, I feel, for Bonner and his conservative or integrationist philosophy. And, you know, as we've noted as well, that, you know, in the 70s and the late 1960s, this kind of philosophy really ran counter to the radical atmosphere of the time.
Now, how did Bonner get the Queensland Senate seat in Parliament? He called it, of course, the nation's Council of Elders.
That's right. And it was a very kind of respectful nod to overlapping tradition there and the relevancy of our existing institution. So prior to 1971, he'd actually ran as third on the joint coalition ticket at the 1970 Senate election. It seemed he kind of just made the decision on the fly at a cocktail party down the Gold Coast at a Liberal fundraiser, actually. He didn't win, but the two ahead of him on the ticket ended up getting elected. But his fortunes changed about 6 months later. So earlier the following year, in around March 71, Senator Dame Annabel Rankin was appointed High Commissioner to New Zealand, which of course creates a Senate vacancy. And I think Bonner, likely for the very first time in his life, actually felt entitled. And I think there's some truth there, because he was the natural choice for the next in line, if you will, to fill the Senate vacancy, having gone through a full process only months before. And, you know, it was certainly a landmark moment when he filled that. 50 years ago, he got applause from people like Charles Perkins, as you note, but even people like, you know, Joe Bjelke-Petersen, Premier at the time.
Why the Liberal Party, Sean? Why was Bonner attracted to the Liberal Party in the late 60s?
It's an interesting question. You know, whenever Bonner was asked why he was a Liberal, he often recited a story from 1967. And it kind of goes that Bonner was handing out how-to-vote cards for a couple of Liberal mates at an Oxley polling booth, which is in the west of Brisbane. And for listeners who remember, Bill Hayden, who was the federal Labor MP for Oxley at the time, saw Bonner and as he hopped out the car, and he couldn't believe that an Indigenous person was volunteering for a member of the Liberal Party, and an exchange kind of followed. And, you know, where Hayden said something to the effect that we do more for you than the other bloody lot do. And I think Bonner was really kind of stumped and taken back, because, you know, he really felt that how you look shouldn't determine how you vote. And he said, you know, look, Mr. Hayden, I'd look pretty bloody silly if I was handing out for you lot when I'm a member of the Liberal Party. So later that night, he filled out membership forms and became a card-carrying member. But it's a good story. But I do write that, you know, at the same time, he actually had a fierce respect for Liberal principles and a bit more of a philosophy than he let on.
Yes, you're right. He revered Robert Menzies.
That's right. So, you know, if you go through Menzies' Liberal philosophy and Bonner's life and beliefs, they almost overlap near perfectly. And you see this in a number of ways. You mentioned the Council of Elders. Well, Bonner had a fierce respect, like Menzies, for Parliament and the rule of law. And he famously said that we don't want a separate Parliament. We want more Aborigines in this chamber. You know, the other point around freedom of speech and religion, Bonner said when coming to Canberra that his priorities were, you know, to God, to nation and state and then party, in that rank order. And not forgetting, of course, religion had been Bonner's path to assimilation and integration. So you can sort of go down the list and really see, you know, protection from exploitation, which Menzies believed strongly in, to an individual initiative and enterprise, and creating opportunities regardless of complexion. Those are really things that spoke to Bonner's life, and I think why he revered Menzies as well as just Liberal principles.
My guest is Sean Jacobs, author of a new biography on Neville Bonner. Now, you're right that Neville Bonner understood the tension, I think this is very important, between protest and compromise. These are your words. Bonner recognised it was better to work within the system and not in spite of it. Here's a Bonner quote: "If you want to beat the system, you do it in a sensible, quiet way." Sean Jacobs.
You know, there's a really interesting instance that I recount in the book in 1973 when he was confronted by hundreds of, riled pro-Indigenous protesters marching towards Parliament House. And he pointed to the chamber, Bonner, and he said, "That's Australia's Council of Elders, and you wouldn't dare walk into an Aboriginal Council of Elders, so why would you march into that one?" And I think it's a really kind of telling point, you know, especially around what else he said around wanting to be part and parcel of the Australian community and wanting to see more Aborigines in this chamber, quote unquote. But it really, again, just pointed to his respect for Parliament and the system. And I think, you know, obviously earned him an army of enemies at the time.
Now, you set out some of the policy issues he cared passionately about: capital punishment, which is interesting, different era back then, in the late 60s and 70s. He's passionate about liberty, free enterprise, civic responsibility. Australian of the Year, 1979. Now, despite his achievements, he was relegated to third on the Queensland Senate ticket in 1983. Now, this was much to the later regret of Malcolm Fraser and John Howard. What happened there?
That's right. So both those men, Tom, said that it was a low moment in the history of the party. And, you know, it was felt that Bonner at the time was tactically not appealing. Others felt that he wasn't doing enough to court branch members and pre-selectors. And so being third on the ticket at the time put him in a virtually unwinnable position. You know, Bonner said that, you know, his parliamentary career was ended by the power brokers on the Hill.
Now, he died in 1999 at age 77. One of his last public acts was to defend the monarchy against the Republican motions put up at the 98 Constitutional Convention in Canberra. Now, these days, as you write in your book, Sean, we're becoming accustomed to outbreaks of acute racial sensitivity. You know, we hear there's trigger warnings, the need for safe spaces. What do you think Neville Bonner would make of identity politics today?
Well, Tom, I think he'd be very, very sceptical. I think he'd be very surprised, actually, too, that given that all had been done for race relations in Australia, that he helped, of course, and the reconciliation between individuals and the sheer amount of Indigenous people doing well today, that racial sensitivity would be running hot still in some places. I do write in the book about his integrationist and equality agenda, you know, no settlements, no special legislation and no special funding. But I think given the divisive nature of identity politics, you know, tearing black and white apart, he'd see it as rather terrible. In 1993, Tom, upon receiving his honorary doctorate from Griffith Uni, Bonner said a really wonderful thing, that a piano, like a society, sounds best when the black and white keys are actually played together. And it's a really great antidote to identity politics. But his life and Bonner's life's a really great antidote to it as well.
That is a lovely message, Neville Bonner. The things you learn on RN. Sean, it's been a pleasure having you on RN to acknowledge the 50th anniversary of Neville Bonner's election to the Senate.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sean Jacobs is author of a new biography on Neville Bonner, which is published by Connor. Well, that's it for the week. And remember to hear this or past episodes, including our recent shows on Afghanistan with Paul Wolfowitz, John Mearsheimer and Lydia Khalil. Just go to abc.net.au/RN and follow the prompts to Between the Lines. Or just go to the ABC Listen app, where you can download us for free or wherever you get your shows online. Now, join me next week to hear from the generation who are inheriting the extraordinary fallout from COVID-19. How do they see the handling of this global pandemic, and what do they see as the path to recovery? I'm Tom Switzer. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.